year. Black people, who account for 13% of the U.S. population, accounted for 27% of those fatally shot and killed by police. Cruel policing. There have also been high-profile cases, from Keenan Anderson, who shouted, "They're trying to George Floyd me," to Tyree Nichols, who was brutally killed by police.
Relax.
Man, I can't breathe my face. Just get up.
What do you want?
I can't breathe. Please, the knee in my neck. I can't breathe shit.
Why is this happening at such an alarming rate anyway?
Very frankly, this is nothing new that's going on in this country. America was built off the blood and the pain of my ancestors. America has always been killing black men. This did not just start this generation. This is just the first generation that's able to see it. Why it keeps going is because the people in power allow it to keep going. When you're dealing with racism, when you're dealing with discrimination in jobs, discrimination in housing, discrimination on the banks. You understand that you're in a society.
America, of course, was not the only slave-holding country in the West that committed horrible things against black people. While other Western countries seem to have distanced themselves from the shameful legacies of the history of slavery, America is lagging behind.
I think America, like many states that have the history of colonization, imperialism, and so forth, are yet to, and this is predominantly within the global where, in the global north, these countries have to confront that. And America is not unique in this particular context. I suppose if one is to look at America's uniqueness, it would be in the difficulty to confront that particular history in a fashion that is honest and truthful. If you look at countries like South Africa, when they looked at, how best you reshape a society that has been divided by apartheid and so forth, they looked at a holistic societal approach. We can question the efficacy, but there's what we can look at within the context of the discourse we're having is that historically, if these issues are not discussed, like in South Africa, they had that discussion. The Truth Commission, right? Truth and Healing Commission, I think they called it at the time.
According to the Pew Research Survey, black adults are about five times as likely as whites to say they've been unfairly stopped by police because of their race or ethnicity. What are the root causes of this discrimination?
Every black American feels a little nervous when a police officer arrives behind them, maybe even is approaching them, because we've seen so much abuse, so much trauma. We all need therapy. We know that it only takes a look, just saying the wrong thing, and you might end up wrestling with the police. And I truly believe, this is what's causing some of the panicking that you see in these videos with black civilians. When you see someone, trying to escape the police, it's not like always, I have something on me, or, I'm a criminal and I want to run. No, sometimes it's just like, I don't want to die.
Black people have been historically subject to decades of segregation, disinvestment, redlining, and mass incarceration. This legacy still shows itself in the form of heavy and disproportionate surveillance and violence by police.
Black people, you know, my people, are captured and contained into, and through generations, right? New mechanisms to further punish, to further destroy any element of dignity and history and language. And then after that, you know, introduce an abolishment movement of slavery and so forth, and put them into society with no instruments of survival, no education, no critical frameworks that enable human existence to at least demonstrate parity and enable people to be emboldened to do it for themselves. Nothing of the sort. They're simply left at their own whim. Right, and are expected to survive and historically to perpetuate. We've seen a lot of great movements, you know, from the, as I pointed to, you know, the Civil Acts, you know, Civil Rights Act, signage in 1964. And I definitely see that as a step forward. But we've never seen any great policies that look at the holistic institutions from a fundamental basis as to what is the idea that drives it, social class and so forth, but furthermore, how racism plays into that particular issue.
The same survey shows nearly two-thirds of black adults, that's about 65%, say they've been in situations where people acted as if they were suspicious of them because of their race or ethnicity. So it's not just the police, it's like a culture.
I would say it's a culture of ignorance, a culture of stupidity. This is nothing to be happy about. This is animalistic. To be suspicious of someone because of the color of their skin, some of the most loving, some of the most successful people I have ever met in the world was black people. And because of their skin, do you see how ignorant that sounds, brother? To even have a discussion like that. But when you're conditioned from a child to think that black people are criminals, to think that all black people are in gangs, to think that all black people might want to rob you, and you hear the hip hop music and it's all kill this dude, kill that dude, then you begin to think maybe black people are dangerous.
Heavy militaristic police presence, frequent stops and searches based on pretext, and disparaging language are all evidence that police view black and brown people with suspicion and fear. These groups of people are not served by police, rather, they are subjugated by them.
Imagine me walking down the street and someone felt a certain type of way about me. You don't even know I'm a 7-time author. I'm a professional basketball player. But because of our melanin that we have in our skin, because of our woolly hair, some people are intimidated by that. And it's not just a culture of ignorance, it's also fear. A lot of it is fear. Some people naturally fear black people, and we can't apologize for that. That's between you and God. That's your problem.
Every time there's a high-profile case of a black person killed by U.S. police, there will be so much talk and protest to address the root causes and so on. So what is it? Nobody knows the root causes, or is it that nobody listens, or perhaps both?
The reason why we are going through these experiences is because society is fundamentally impacted. And then the representatives of society through policing, through social work and care work services, through the education system, the perception of teachers amongst black children, especially teachers who are in their majority white, middle class, you know, how do they relate to these particular children, and how is that relation, how does that relation rather speak to society in the pupils' latter stages? Okay, so it's an entire societal prognosis that requires a holistic approach, not just policing, not just healthcare, but holistically, even within the very cultures of those that lead us politically.
Since the killings of George Floyd and Breonna Taylor prompted unprecedented uprisings, some racial justice groups have successfully pressured municipal lawmakers to cut police funding and reinvest the money in services. That call has been made every time there has been a high-profile case of police brutality.
If you want to change something, you do it through two ways in this world. Loss of life or loss of profit. Loss of life or loss of profit. Now, we don't advocate violence. That's something we don't do. And that's what people have to understand about Black Americans. We do not advocate violence. Don't let hip-hop music generalize you about Black people. That's ignorant. Don't let what you see in movies generalize you about Black. That's ignorant. You can't never let that happen. But we understand that if you want to change something, if you're not going to do loss of life, then you have to hit the loss of profit. Do we want to defund the police? No. We want to stop getting killed in the streets. We want to stop getting harassed. It's the police who wants to defund the police because they are the root to the problem. Don't ask us if we want to defund the police. The police wants to defund the police because they work for the people and they don't do their job.
Some people argue that police defunding will only lead to more crimes across the nation and something that would hurt the Black community even more because they are seen as more vulnerable. Others also argue that this defunding will affect the poorer areas, which are populated more by Black people, more than affluent neighborhoods of white people.
Yes, in the sense that I understand the principle of defunding the police and I understand its foundational ideas around, you know, a much more policed society by, you know, coming from an abolitionist, if you will, mindset, which encouraged, you know, society to be engaged within its own policing and so forth, right? Societal responsibility. I understand that. But do I think defunding them? There are elements within defunding and the defunding campaign, and I don't think that they are actually thinking in the classical sense that I was describing. I was simply giving a historical perspective. But if I'm to look at the things that I do agree with, it's that there has to be societal engagement. And this is one of the tenets that they're pushing for. So less funding towards policing and the militarization of policing, but much more funding going towards the societal aspects that this policing society has to help govern, right? In governing, right? In administering that society.
The conventional wisdom is that Democrats care about the needs of the Black community more than Republicans. Do Democrats really care about African Americans, or are they pursuing some sort of political gains here?
Though, when it comes to social programs and much more grassroots-centered policies that would favor, you know, disadvantaged communities in which, you know, black Africans and black minority as well as Latinos, Hispanics are in. Okay, so it does make sense where a lot of this mindset comes from. But politics in itself is changing. From the notion of identity politics to wokeness to, you know, be it Marxist libertarianism and so forth, and all these different things are going through a process, and this is globally. But in America, we're seeing the same concerns that what is taking much more prevalence through the emergence of Trump is perhaps a tiredness of the collective society in as far as liberalism policies have been working out, from a multilateral institution to globalization. How have we fared compared to other countries, right? So they just bring back this greatness, right? But there is no greatness to really look at, considering that we have been discussing the history of slavery and how, you know, as Black people in America, as the Black Americans have been able to demonstrate a strong global soft power through their popular culture. But this has been fundamentally done through their own efforts, not a large number of policies that have been able to look at that from an institutional perspective that is fundamentally overwhelming, to the point that, you know, an entire populations can move away from poverty to the middle class. We're not seeing that. What we're seeing is something totally different. A society that came together and built its own stuff, and it now has a soft.
Political divisions are also apparent when viewing police misconduct toward racial and ethnic minorities. For example, a Pew Research Center poll found that 61% of Republicans compared to 21% of Democrats endorsed the belief that race was getting too much attention following the shooting of Michael Brown, an unarmed 18-year-old young Black man who was fatally shot by a police officer in Ferguson, Missouri in 2014.
This soft power that the Black community now has to be bargained between the two. I think now the politics that Black Americans now have to play is one of collective bargaining. What will you do for me as a consequence of my vote, as the Jewish community would do, as my other Indian sort of minority entities have been doing, communities rather have been doing, even here in England, right, to the point in which we now have in the UK, an Indian prime minister. So we have to use our collective bargaining, political soft power, as a tool that will lead to our own economic transformation, which means that the Christians, the Black Christian community, has to collaborate with the Nation of Islam. The Nation of Islam has to collaborate with the Black Jewish community, right? There needs to be that, you know, a collective approach. Then when we have that collective approach, we can use that not only from a local policy standpoint, but equally the international. There are multilateral institutions that such an entity, such a collective bargaining instrument or institution would be able to do as a minority group amongst other international platforms, as to lobby for their own heritage, which to them will be inherently Africa.
Police are occupying forces in many urban Black and brown communities. People of color too poor to live in a middle class or wealthier neighborhood because of decades of segregation, disinvestment, redlining, and mass incarceration are subjected to heavy and disproportionate surveillance and violence by police. Black people are twice as likely as white people to be shot and killed by a police officer.
We don't know if the world sees us. You know, like, so many people, oh, the United States is this, the United States, but do y'all see how Black Americans are being treated here? You know, we wonder, because we see how y'all, you know, our other countries, they're going through problems. You know, we send donations, we send money, we send help and support. But we wonder if people see us. We are wondering if people understand how badly we deserve reparations. When European Jewish people came out of the Holocaust, they got reparations the next day. You see how they solved their problem? They had their problem solved by reparations. So obviously reparations must be the solution, but nobody wants to talk about it. How do we stop these episodes from repeating themselves? Reparations. That's how it stopped for so-called Jewish people.
Reforming policing will require numerous changes that include improving hiring and training practices and establishing clear standards for what is proper policing, what constitutes misconduct, and appropriate and inappropriate use of force and policing tactics and tools.
I suppose the best way to avoid stoppage of such instances within a short-term context would be, of course, looking at policy. How best can we reform the policing structure? And it could speak to, you know, the immediate need to not perhaps defund, but fund more diverse programs that are also inclusive, so that there's a multi-agency approach to policing that society. You have your social workers, healthcare groups, early childcare intervention programs. You're looking at that whole society and approaching the problem from not one diagnosis, but rather a multitude of concerns that you want to deal with simultaneously. That would be a good short-term program that the Democrats perhaps could push. And I think the language, in order for the Republicans to be agreeable to it, is the policing aspect, the law and order, because you're not taking away funding. You're saying you're going to add more funding. But what you're going to try to do is to diversify how that funding is distributed, right? So it's reframing the language, looking at how best we can quickly intervene into communities from early intervention, so we'll be looking at a scale and indices that are, you know, we're looking at long-term results here. We're not looking at things that will help you win the next election, because I think that's the myopia of policymaking.
Prosecutors know the barometer for what we consider to be criminal conduct for police officers is extremely high, both legally and in the public's perception. Most people perceive that if a police officer did something, he or she was doing it for their protection or the greater good of society. So, the bar for charging and convicting police officers is higher than the bar for regular citizens. Prosecutors then often take more time to ensure that a case is solid before they bring charges, if ever.
Muhammad is my guide, Muhammad is my teacher, Muhammad my beloved Rasulullah.
I want to be like you.
Like you.
In everything I do, Ya Rasulullah.
I want to walk like you, talk like you, read my Quran just like you. Rasulullah.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Welcome to this program, Like Muhammad from IRIB English Radio. This is Rajabian. I am a seminary student doing my Kharij studies, and I am doing my PhD on Islamic studies. Inshallah, in this program, we will talk about the Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alayhi wa alayhi wa sallam. How the Holy Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa alayhi wa sallam dealt with his own Ahlul Bayt or progeny. Well, it's of a great importance to know that how to behave with your own family, and how you can be, you know, make your life in this world and in hereafter by the behavior, you know, having good behavior in respect to your own family, or being bad tempered toward them and having misbehavior toward them, to ruin everything. It is very important. But there is a very important, a special point about the Holy Prophet. What is that special point? You know that it is highly encouraged and said to us in Islam, in different verses of the Quran and in the hadith of Ahlul Bayt, the Holy Prophet, that whenever someone does something for you, when you have a worker, he's working for you, so before his sweat, dries, it is said that gives him his wage. I mean, the thing that you had, agreed upon that to be paid, I mean, to that person. You should do that. Now, it comes in mind that what about the Holy Prophet sallallahu alaihi wa sallam? You know, for 23 years he worked so hard to preach Islam and to disseminate and to spread the word of Islam and the word of Tawheed, unity. How much he suffered from different things. In Mecca for 13 years he was under the highest pressures and sanctions by his own family. And he was, you know, just suffering a lot of problems. And after that, when he moved to Medina, he migrated to Medina and established that Islamic government there, then the other nations, I mean, whether, you know, you say that the nation states or nation cities or whatever, they started to just, you know, attack the Islam to stop spreading the word of Islam, which was the word of, you know, unity of God, the word of love. They tried to stop it. They saw, I mean, all people saw that now, if Islam, you know, arrives and sits in their lands, then maybe their interest will be in problem and a lot of things will happen to them. So here we see that they waged wars against the Prophet. So how the Prophet was suffering from these wars. You know, imagine in the Battle of Uhud, the Prophet was about to be martyred, and he was, you know, Amirul Mu'mineen and seven other, you know, faithful people that they remained, they stayed with the Prophet, protected him and he himself, and then they were saved from that battle. So all of those things that happened to the Holy Prophet, all of the sufferings that he had from the beginning of his Risala, of his message and messengership, till the last moments and his passing away on the last days of the month of Safar. So here, for doing all of these things, didn't he deserve any reward? That people say that, okay, you have done this for us, now we should, you know, pay it back to you. So what was that reward? So it was something very important issue that really matters, and the Quran has told us what to do. Well, the Holy Quran said, قُلْ لَا أَسْأَلُكُمْ عَلَيْهِ أَجْرًا إِلَّا الْمَوَدَّةَ فِي الْقُرْبَى. So I want one thing from you. So I have done all of this to guide you to the right path, to help you with your lives. And now I only, after 23 years of doing these things, I want one thing from you. And that is to love my qurba, my Ahlul Bayt, those, relatives of kins of me.
My heart is so full of longing. I wish to be close to my beloved. I dream to walk in the streets of Medina and to quench the thirst of my spirit by visiting you, O Muhammad. As-salamu alayka ya Rasul Allah. As-salamu alayka habibi ya Nabi
Welcome back to this program from IRIB English Radio, Like Muhammad. We said that the Holy Prophet, after suffering for many years and, doing a lot of works to guide people to the right path, he said that I don't want anything from you and any reward from you, but to love my Ahlul Bayt, to love my Qurba. So who were these Qurba? Qurba is someone who is next to your kin, he is so close to you. And we see that those who were so close to the Prophet were his progeny. It was Sayyida Fatima, salamullahi alayha, Amir al-Mu'mineen alayhi salam, Imam al-Hasan and Imam al-Husayn alayhi salam at that time. So therefore, what the Prophet wanted us at that time was that to give him back what he has done for us, all the things that he has suffered because of us, To give it back, just, you know, love the Ahlul Bayt. And love, or mawadda in Arabic, we have mahabba and mawadda. Mahabba means that you just love someone without any action. By words, I say that I love you, for example, just this. But when it comes to mawadda, means you should show it in practice. I mean, I love that person, and I should prove that I love that person. And that, you know, those Ahlul Bayt alayhimus salam. So, because it was an order coming from God, the Holy Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa sallam himself started practicing that, practicing this mawadda in respect to Ahlul Bayt alayhimus salam. Well, after the verse of Tathir, verse number 33 of the surah number 33 of the Quran, Suratul Ahzab, was revealed to the Prophet, he just every day, you know, it was about the Ahlul Bayt alayhimus salam, was about Amirul Mu'minin, Sayyida Fatima, Imam al-Hasan and Imam al-Husayn alayhimus salam. Every day, at the time of the prayers, he went to the house, to the door of the Sayyida Fatima, and said that, you know, this is the time of the prayers, O Ahlul Bayt. إِنَّمَا يُرِيدُ اللَّهُ لِيُثِبَ عَنْكُمْ رِجْسَ أَهْلَ الْبَيْتِ وَيُطَهِرَكُمْ تَطْهِيرًا. So, you know, he repeated that, to tell the people that, all people, the qurba, that the Quran is saying that these are the, loving them in practice is your duty, and it is my reward, the reward of my messengership for 23 years is just, you know, to love them are these people who are in this house. And, you know, in other cases, how he dealt with Sayyida Fatima, how he dealt with Amirul Mu'minin alayhi salam, with Imam al-Hasan and Imam al-Husayn, how he loved them in practice. So this is the tradition of Ahlul Bayt alayhi salam, and it shows our duty as, you know, Muslims in all over the world, that if we are really devout in respect to the Holy Prophet, and if we really love him, and if we really admit him as a prophet, so the Quran has told us that you people, you should do in respect to Ahlul Bayt, to give the reward of the messengership of Imam Ahlul Bayt alayhimus salam. You know, it was one of the cases that the Holy Prophet told us that who are the Ahlul Bayt, who are the Qurba, that we should, you know, show that love to them. Well, may Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala gives us this success and, you know, this opportunity, this tawfiq, to be the true followers of the Holy Prophet and his words, and, you know, apply them in our lives to make our lives better. So thank you very much for being with me from IRIB English Radio.
Be like Muhammad, live like Muhammad, see like Muhammad did. Be like Muhammad and live like Muhammad and give like Muhammad gave. Shafi'ullah, Habibullah, Nabiullah, Rasulullah, Khalilullah, the friend of Allah, ya Rasulullah, Rasulullah.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
It's the show where we discuss the most topical of topics, the most controversial of controversies, and the most important affairs of affairs.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to IRIB English Radio. Thank you very much for joining us in a new episode of The House of Truth, Back to Reality, Well, I am Asma. I have the privilege to be your host. And here with me, I have Brother Hassanain from India and Sister Zainab from India as well. Well, I'm so happy to have you here both. Would you please introduce yourself very much briefly?
Assalamu alaikum. I am Zainab Askari from Indian Administrative Kashmir.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Salamu alaikum, sisters, and salamu alaikum everyone listening to the IRIB English Radio. I'm Hassanain from India.
So, welcome both of you. And let's just start today's episode. Well, since we're getting close to Persian New Year, let's talk about New Year as in general format. Well, in different cultures, different societies have their own New Year's. And it happens to be Eastern, Western, wherever you go, there is a New Year for every single society and culture. Now, the thing is, what do you see in the concept of New Year?
New Year in general, different cultures see it differently, different people see it differently, different individuals see it differently. So I, as an individual...
Well, let me ask you this question. What is the first thing that comes to your mind when we talk about New Year?
Making resolutions.
Oh, yeah. Very true. And you?
End of the year.
So...
If it's like... it was 2022, like, you know, 3 months ago, and January 2023 started. So just 2022 ended.
So that's it.
So just one year ends and the other year begins.
Yeah. So what people... what?
It happens. Does he feel that? So...
It is actually, that's the thing, right? Like, you know, New Year means the start of the new year.
Mm-hmm.
One year ends and the new year starts.
But nothing else comes to your mind like...
No, just... you asked me the first thing.
Yeah, the first thing.
So that's the first thing, you know, like 12 when the clock strikes 12.
Yeah.
At the start of a new year.
Yeah. I feel scared when we talk of New Year.
Why?
I don't know why. The first thing that comes to my mind is that I feel scared because I don't know what might happen in the next year.
Be optimistic.
Yeah.
You may be amazed. In my New Year resolutions, the first thing that I do is I update my failure resume. So now you might be thinking, in resume, you always write the things that you have achieved.
Your accomplishments.
Yeah, my failure resume is this thing. It's a list of things where I have failed in my life.
Mm-hmm.
And on New Year, I make sure that at least five things.
I make sure I would make more failures in the next year.
All right. These I make more ladders to do success. Mm-hmm. I have an optimistic mind. So I update my failure resume, add more failures of that ending year, and then have this will, this thing in my mind that at least in these failures, I'm going to turn them into achievements in this year.
So that's very nice. And do you do these resolutions at New Year Eve?
Actually, it's a good thing, like, if you have resolutions and all. Like, I personally didn't have any resolutions yet. You know, like, not for a specific... I might have my own resolutions, but nothing, like, specific date. Like, you know, New Year, I make my new resolutions. It's whenever I feel like, you know, I need a change
exactly,
in my life.
Yeah.
Whenever I need a change in my life, so I follow that.
Mm-hmm.
And when we talk about New Year, the first thing that also comes in my mind is, like, what New Year are we talking about?
You know, when we talk of New Year, now many people have different attitudes towards it. Some people make resolutions. Some people feel scared.
Because it's a matter of taste.
Yeah, exactly. It's a matter of taste. So what you do? Nothing. It's just an ordinary day and night like the other days, and it would just go away.
Yeah, for me, like it was just normal. Like
a matter of calendar.
A matter of calendar. You know, actually, New Year is also, I guess, like somewhat a psychological thing.
Exactly. Yeah, it is.
You know, it's in reality, it might be the same day.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's just nothing. Like it was just like 31st of December. Now it's 1st of January.
Yeah.
So it's the same thing. Like nothing changed. Like Like poverty didn't vanish from the world, or you know the conditions didn't get better. It might be the same thing. It's better if it happens.
It's not like in just a night or a day, a miracle happens to the entire world and everything is just utopia.
You feel like you know it's a new year. The time changed. So for people, as Sister also mentioned, and you know it's a psychological thing. You know people write resolutions and they, in fact, it's a good opportunity. I don't deny it. Being, you know, making no difference doesn't mean like, you know, it's nothing.
Like brother said, it matters which new year starts when. For example, as the January came in, and in this the way this calendar, like where your year starts from January and ends in December, here I make resolutions for the world.
Yeah.
For my achievements, failures, and all. But if my new year is on, according to the solar calendar, according to the Iranian calendar, we have celebrations, we have gatherings, mm-hmm. we have cooking different foods.
Yeah.
And if it's in Muharram, we again have resolutions, but here the resolutions are spiritual ones.
Different, pretty much different. Now, this is just the introduction. Let's go for a short break and then we'll come to continue.
This is IRIB English Radio. You're listening to Back to Reality.
So we're talking about New Year's, and this is Back to Reality. Well, Brother Hassan and Sister Zainab are helping me with this discussion. And actually, we were talking about the fact that New Year has got different concept in different societies for different people. So it's a matter of taste. And the most important thing about it is that it is going to be a new start. In the Persian calendar, New Year, the name of the New Year, the expression we use is Nowruz. And that means literally the new day. So I guess the entire idea behind this New Year stuff is that we should start a new day and a new era for ourselves, which is going to go for a year, and then the cycle goes round and round and round. So what are your ideas, Brother Hassan, on this very fact that it is going to be a new start, a new leaf of a book for me to write a new diary?
Yeah, as I have mentioned earlier, you know, there might not be like literal changes. Just, you know, you just shift the date. You know, you just turn a page in your calendar. But this might be an opportunity for us.
Exactly.
Like, you know, people use this New Year so that they remember, like, what have they have done in the past year.
Mm-hmm.
And where, in what fields they can improve themselves.
Yeah. You know, I would say it's much more of an excuse than make people think
exactly
what they have done up until now.
Yeah, it's an opportunity for people. You remember your achievements and where you were falling short, mm-hmm. that you can improve it.
The idea of New Year, we said that it is like a new book. They're giving it to you.
It's the beginning of a new dawn in your life. And since I have been, from the time, it also depends on your experiences. The experiences mm-hmm. you have been having each year, your vision to New Year also changes. For example, now onwards, like since I read actually Surah Inshiqaq, wherein one of the things was, it was Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala was starting with the swearings and all, but one thing that he was focusing on, putting more emphasis, was that with every stage you're getting closer to a meeting
mm-hmm.
with me. So this meeting could be either face to face, or you would be having your back towards me. So now in this world you have the opportunity to turn towards me, if you in this world you turn towards me, you will be having a face to face meeting with me and receiving your book of deeds in the right hand.
Mm-hmm.
And if in this world you turn back towards me, which is like disobeying his commands, and then you will receive your book in the left hand.
Yeah.
So it says tabakan and tabak, you are actually stage by stage, level by level, heading towards a meeting. So the concept is, now my concept of Nivya spiritually is that I'm heading towards a meeting, and I make sure that this meeting is as good as possible. And the, mm-hmm. I should make sure that this meeting should be face-to-face
one.
Thank you.
because we look at every sign of nature that is given to us, ironically, in a way that we get more of meaning from it, we would understand that at the very beginning of autumn, all the leaves come down from the trees. So just like what we do throughout our life, a year, just imagine how many sins I have done in this year. So all those are going to come down from my body and I forget about them. I would just eliminate them from my brain. And then when a spring comes, when the sun comes out from behind the clouds, when everything is shiny, when the leaves of the trees are going to go green, I, as a person, am going to go that way exactly, just like the way brother said it.
Yes, as you know, actually compared it, the spring with the blue being the darkness of life and then having hope. I was just writing a thing. I was writing a couple of lines some time ago. It was like, if you consider hair, in spring, basically, if your new year starts in the spring, like that of an Iran Nowruz. And then I was writing, I was comparing, like I was giving the name gardener to God here. So create the splendor of spring, O gardener, when the flowers blossom, nightingales sing, bring such welfare, O gardener.
O gardener,
So that's nice. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, as I was focusing on the psychological effect, so, and as you have mentioned as well, that, you know, it's an excuse for us, for people to improve. Mm-hmm. I would say, like, it's an opportunity for people to improve. You know, if we look into human lives, we are always in search of a moment where we can change ourselves.
Yeah.
And we just give excuses. You know, like, you know, if we look at the basic examples, you want to go to the gym, you want to start working out. But you feel lazy to do that.
From Saturday,
From Saturday, from Sunday, from next month, like, you know, after the holidays, after the weekend.
From the New Year's.
Yeah, so if we look at this, New Year is a big image, right?
Yeah.
Like, compared to the Saturday and next month, next day, next week, New Year is a new image. So people, you know, get an opportunity to make the resolutions and, you know, look at their, you know, previous or past achievements, what they have done. And so that, you know, they can improve themselves. And as mentioned, we humans, we basically have to contemplate on our daily lives, like, you know, before we sleep.
Mm-hmm.
So New Year gives us a chance to contemplate on the year we have gone through.
Exactly.
How a good human I have been in this year.
So you mean just as every night we have the time to think about what we have done in a day, the New Year Eve is exactly the time for us to go for whatever we have done through the year.
Right.
And that is going to be a new start for us to go for everything we want to change in ourselves and improve ourselves.
Exactly.
Yeah. So I still would love to talk more about the New Year because we still have a lot more to say. But that's all the time that we have for today's episode. Thank you, dear listeners. I hope you enjoyed it. Until another session, I bid you farewell. May Allah protect you with His never-slipping eyes. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
I pray to God, my heart, soul, and body, every single day of my life, with every breath. I solemnly promise to try to live my life for you. Oh Allah, you did revive my soul and shone your light into my heart. So please, you is now my only goal. Oh, I love you so, I love you so,
I love you so.
Now I know how it's like to have your precious love in my life. Now I know how it feels to finally be at peace inside. I wish that everybody knew how amazing it feels to love you. I wish that everyone could see how you love. Set me free and make me strong.
the limelight.
Frustration has only mounted for climate advocates throughout Biden's presidency. Though Biden pledged to end new oil and gas leasing on federal lands, his administration has been approving permits at a breakneck pace. Federal data has shown that in Biden's first 2 years, he has approved even more permits for oil and gas drilling than Donald Trump did in the same amount of time. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites for further details. Stay tuned for more. Truthout wrote in this regard, climate justice advocates are condemning President Joe Biden for approving a massive oil drilling proposal in northern Alaska known as Willow, which will now be one of the largest new drilling projects in the U.S. The $8 billion project proposed by ConocoPhillips will be located in Alaska's North Slope, a majority Native American area. The drilling will take place over the next few decades on pristine land in the petroleum reserve across three drilling pads and will involve the building of hundreds of wells and hundreds of miles of pipelines. The company would ironically be required to refreeze permafrost that's been melting due to global warming caused by companies like ConocoPhillips and others in the fossil fuel industry. Willow is expected to worsen the climate crisis and even further entrench the fossil fuel industry's grip over the energy markets, and has been condemned by Al Gore as recklessly irresponsible. It would release a carbon bomb of nearly 260 million metric tons of carbon emissions, amounting to double the amount of carbon dioxide saved from current Biden administration climate projects, or the annual output of nearly a third of all U.S. coal power plants. The approval of the project goes directly against Biden's campaign trail promise of no more drilling on federal lands, period. Earth Justice has pledged to challenge the approval in court and says that the Biden administration had the authority to stop the project or at least substantially reduce its carbon output, but chose not to do either. We are not too late in the climate crisis to approve massive oil and gas projects that directly undermine the new clean economy that Biden administration committed to advancing, Earth Justice President Abigail Dillon said in a statement, adding, "We know President Biden understands the existential threat of climate, but he's approving a project that derails his own climate goals." On top of the climate impacts of the project, local indigenous communities have warned that the project would endanger their health. The plans for Willow put it just 36 miles away from Nuixt, a community made up of largely Native Americans who worry that between Willow and other oil and gas infrastructure surrounding the community, cancer caused by air and other pollution is not just a possibility but an inevitability, as Atmos magazine reported. Many prominent climate and justice organizations decried Biden's decision. President Biden claims to prioritize climate justice, yet today's decision reveals that he is quick to cater to pressure from big oil over the needs of the people, said 350.org North America Director Jeff Ordower, adding, Biden absolutely has the power to reject all new fossil fuel projects, declare a climate emergency, and truly fight for both our people and our planet. Frontline communities and scientists have been clear that that is the only way forward. Food and Water Watch called the approval another massive climate disappointment from Biden. There is simply no justification for President Biden's decision to approve a massive new oil drilling scheme that will lead to decades of air and climate pollution, said Food and Water Watch Executive Director Venoa Hutter, adding, this decision is part of a disturbing and disappointing trend with this White House. Biden refuses to take the necessary actions to rein in climate catastrophe while issuing rhetoric that professes concern for the existential threat that we all face. The decision was also criticized by lawmakers like Senator Ed Markey from Massachusetts, who said that the disastrous decision is an environmental injustice. The administration is also expected to announce new restrictions on Arctic Ocean offshore oil leasing and on drilling elsewhere in the North Slope, but advocates say that that wouldn't justify approving the Willow project. It's insulting that Biden thinks this will change our minds about the Willow Project, Kristen Munsell, senior attorney for the Center for Biological Diversity, told the New York Times, adding, protecting one area of the Arctic so you can destroy another doesn't make sense, and it won't help the people and wildlife who will be upended by the Willow Project. According to the Associated Press, approval of the project would represent a betrayal by Biden, who promised during 2020 campaign to end new oil and gas drilling on federal lands, environmentalists say. Biden has made fighting climate change a top priority and backed a landmark law to accelerate expansion of clean energy such as wind and solar power and move the U.S. away from oil, coal, and gas. He faces attacks from Republican lawmakers who blame Biden for gasoline price spikes that occurred after the Russia-Ukraine crisis.
Ask the followers of the remembrance if ye know not.
You're listening to the program The Key on IRIB English Radio with Shiraz Hossein Agha, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Qom and a PhD in philosophy.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Welcome to our program, The Key, here at IRIB English Radio. Today on The Key, we are going to be asking a very important and a very informative question, and that question is about what are the characteristics of the God-wary and the pious, the muttaqin? You know, we all know that piety is a very important virtue in Islam. It's actually the most significant of virtues. It's the sole criterion of honor and nobility within Islam. But sometimes, you know, it's just something very vague. What does it mean to be pious? Fortunately, we have an answer to this question in the Quran and the Hadith. For example, one verse of the Holy Quran, we read the following. God-wariness is not to turn your faces to the east or the west. God-wariness is personified by those who have faith in Allah and the last day, the angels, the book, and the prophets, and who give their wealth for the love of Him to the needy the traveler and the beggar, and for the freeing of the slaves, and maintain the prayer and give the zakat, and those who fulfill their covenants when they pledge themselves, and those who are patient in stress and distress and in the heat of battle. They are the ones who are true to their covenant, and it is they who are God-wary.